This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
A new government survey of parents suggests that 1 in 45 children ages 3 through 17 have been diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder. This is notably higher than the official government estimate in 1 in 68 American children with autism. That's by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And even though there's been seemingly endless debate about what causes autism, for most parents whose child have the condition, all they care about is helping that child live a full, happy life.
But as parents, they're our kid and they're going to be with us forever.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear my conversation with the people at an autism center for children who specialize in applied behavior analysis. We'll also spend an academic minute with what was my favorite part of the school day, recess. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. The Sacred Heart Autism Center is located among a small group of buildings just off the main campus of Sacred Heart Children's Hospital in Pensacola, Florida. It offers parents of children with autism a number of services, including training and treatment using applied behavior analysis. I toured the facility in December and spoke to some of the staff about what life can be like for the family of a child with autism. Debbie Kermis is the manager of the center, as well as a board-certified behavior analyst. Jennifer Finley is another behavior analyst at the center and a parent of a child with autism. I started by asking Debbie if the new study numbers means there's more autism, or are we just getting better at diagnosing or recognizing it?
Most of the research is saying that we're just getting better at seeing it, that autism has always been around, and that now people are more aware and they're getting diagnoses now and they might not have otherwise. Some adults now are seeing when they have a child possibly that needs a diagnosis or that they're referring for a diagnosis. Sometimes they see a lot of the traits themselves and think that they may have even been on the spectrum but had not been diagnosed.
How has the treatment and understanding of autism changed over the years?
I've been in the field a long time. So when I was taking classes, autism was this little paragraph in a book, not a chapter, not a whole book. It was a little paragraph. And now there's much more information about that. And it's now really considered a spectrum. So we are looking more at all levels of social awareness, of cognitive ability. They're looking really across the board. So we have individuals who are very capable of gifted skills, who are some of the best inventors and people who have the most creative abilities, really unique areas of interest. And so they tend to really excel in that, to children who really have difficulty even communicating at a very early level.
How were the needs of children being met back then? Did we even know what they were then?
I think we did in some ways. I don't think the social piece was as, people were as aware socially now of the needs, you know, the differences socially and how that there's really just a different way of seeing things sometimes, and that some kids can really excel in certain areas. And I think it was more about fitting into the norm then. And now, fortunately, we're starting to get a little bit more diverse and seeing that those are actually strengths that we can capitalize on rather than just looking at deficit areas.
Well, let's talk about that. How are they being capitalized on?
Well, many kids have a unique interest in science or fascination with certain things. Sometimes they have visual acuity that they can kind of put things together really well. So if you allow kids to really focus on those gifts that they've been given, we use those things to help them sometimes in the areas where they do need a little bit more assistance.
Can a center like this help and do things that schools cannot?
I think we just are fine-tuning some of that. I mean, I came from the school district, and there's a lot of variance from one class to another, from one teacher to another. So it's that experience that's really needed. And we try to coordinate services because the more people doing the same thing, obviously, the better off the child's going to be. So applied behavior analysis is the scientific study of behavior. And it's not a new field, but because insurance covers it now and people are more aware, as that increases, you know, as people become more aware of that and how to use those skills, then we can be more effective across the board. But we want to do the same same things. We work with the school district. We don't try to have two separate things going on.
Well, and I would say our biggest addition or difference between the school is that we have the ability to incorporate the parents into what we're doing at the schools. You know, parents often come home and they find out what the kids were doing at school, or they're part of the IEP process, but they're not part of the day-to-day operations of the school. So the parents can come to us and be part of our therapy. They're invited to be in the session with us. We're teaching them the skills of how to work with their kid outside of school and outside of the clinic setting to empower them to make their family life as a whole better for their kid and for them. And I think that really helps the school, obviously, because then the child often does better in school and the teacher appreciates, you know, having that collaboration, and it helps the family. I think that is something unique that we do.
And we'll point out that that IEP is the individualized education plan that schools are required to come up with for children with autism who are attending their school. And schools have to do that until a child reaches the age of 22, then they age out of the system. But let's go back. Is it working? Are schools doing a better job over the past 5-10 years or so at accommodating the needs of children with autism?
I think we definitely have. That's why I became a behavior analyst when I was in the school. So I think that there are definitely some classrooms that are doing some amazing things. But as you get more people, this is a pretty stressful field. It's pretty hard working with kids who can have some challenging behaviors. And so it's not for everybody. So there is a lot of turnover, and there's training needs that are always going on because there's never enough time for training. So that's part of what makes us unique, is that we do a lot of parent training. We do training for professionals. We partner with Autism Pensacola and have a camp in the summer. So we oversee the training for that. And we've trained hundreds and hundreds of people to really assist with working in the classrooms, or paraprofessionals, or speech and language pathologists, occupational therapists, which we have here also, and we collaborate with them. So again, getting everybody the training that they need and keeping everyone on the same page is what's really critical for success. Because the kids, they say sometimes that children on the autism spectrum have difficulty generalizing. Well, it's because we need to teach those skills in the environment where they occur and in the natural environment. So the things that everyday routines and activities that they're doing.
Okay, Jennifer, a quick question for you now. What came first, behavioral analyst or parent of a child with autism?
Parent. Yeah. I became a behavior analyst because my child had needs that I wasn't able to meet as a parent. And once insurance finally started covering ABA, which took a long time, my son was 8 before it started covering it, I learned about what ABA was, got my son in care, and fell in love with it. And it increased his communication and it reduced his problem behaviors. And I said, okay, yep, I'm changing my entire career. That's what I'm doing. So that came first, yeah.
And you've been doing how long?
So I've been an actual behavior analyst for 2 years, and I've been here at the center for 4, I guess, and a parent for 13.
So you have seen from, you know, from day one what these programs can do for a child.
Absolutely, yeah, I'm kind of invested.
So from that perspective, as a parent, what do you see as the changes in programs and tools available for children with autism over the years? What changes have come about?
Yeah, over the years, I think it's been pretty dramatic. So early on, you know, there were things within the school system for your child, and there certainly was speech and occupational therapy, which are amazing. But with my child who had some problem behaviors, sometimes he wasn't able to get what he needed with speech and OT because the behaviors were so difficult, and you really had nowhere to turn. So over the years, we as a community have built up more resources and a support network so that the family can feel like, I have somewhere to go, I have somewhere to turn, somebody understands what I'm going through. And then with the increase of insurance covering behavior analysis, now families actually have access to that as well, and or at least more often they have access to it.
Has the insurance covering it just been a turning point?
A huge turning point. I would say it's only been 5 years or so-ish that insurance as a whole has been covering ABA, and every year it's more that are being covered, and that's been a huge turning point. So it's a lot more readily available out there, especially since Medicaid started covering it for families.
And Debbie, since that happened, have you seen more kids coming in?
Oh, absolutely. But there's still some gaps. We've had a wait list actually since before we opened, and we continue to have a wait list, but the perception is it's extremely long, but that's not necessarily the case. We do get kids in a much more timely manner, but there are a lot of factors that are considered when they can come, how intensive they need, you know, all of those, a lot of other factors.
What do you hope happens in the next 5-10 years? What needs can you not meet now that you would like to in the near future?
I would love to continue with the training and have that more accessible to everyone at times when they're available. Also, to decrease that wait list so that we don't have parents or families who are waiting for services and not sure about when they come. We've adjusted our schedule to be more flexible so that we offer different types of services, because not every family can have a child go to school all day and then have additional things after school. It's very exhausting for them. So really collaborating together, continuing to collaborate so that services are available closer to home in the community for families, and just increasing that variety so that we individualize it, because not every family needs the same thing.
How do children come to you? Are they referred by their primary doctors? And
yes, typically their pediatrician refers them. Sometimes we get referrals from speech or occupational therapy. If they're already in that, they may suggest applied behavior analysis, but they do then go back to their pediatrician and get a referral.
And when a new patient, new child comes in, what do you do? What's the evaluation process?
We actually had one just a few minutes ago, but the family will fill out some paperwork beforehand to give us a little bit of background, and then they will meet with one of our board-certified behavior analysts. Usually they come in for a few hours. It's an extensive parent interview. There's observation of the child. There's some direct assessment of the child, and then we try to get a good picture of where they are, both with their behavior and with specific skills, so skill deficit areas, what kinds of things do they need to work on, but especially what are their strengths? So how do we use those strengths and things to help improve skills that they may need to work on? And then the behavior analyst will write up a plan with all the input that they received from the parent, get back with the parent then and go over that and see if that is meeting the needs. It's usually a 6-month plan, and then we determine a schedule for how often they'll come in, and again, what type of services they need. We have everywhere from Jennifer sees mainly parent, the focus is more on parent training because those families don't come in as frequently as others. Some need more direct and intensive service, but again, all the families are welcome to come so that they're still getting that hands-on practice with them. But we also look at the age of the child and what's needed, because younger kids have some more specific services that we offer. We have some based on the Early Start Denver model, which has shown cognitive gains in those children, but we try to do it early and intensive and get that started. But we also have social skills groups for older kids who maybe have an easier time with language, but need to use it with their peers and find out how to play and accept some of the consequences of their behaviors and those kind of things.
Still to come, my conversation with the staff at the Sacred Heart Autism Center continues with the story of Jennifer's child. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guests today are Debbie Kermes, the manager of the Autism Center at Sacred Heart Children's Hospital in Pensacola, as well as a board-certified behavior analyst, and Jennifer Finley, another behavior analyst at the center and a parent of a child with autism. So I asked Jennifer what she did when she found out her child had a problem.
Yeah, I'm in a little different situation because I actually adopted my son knowing he had autism. So he was 4 when I adopted him, and he was, which is, by the way, another issue that we have, is a lot of our kids end up in the foster care system because of multiple reasons with their families. And so we have some kids even coming here who are in foster care, in and out of different foster homes. And that makes them obtaining services even more difficult. Mm-hmm. So I knew that going into it with my son. And at age 4, you know, you did the best you could with what services that we had available. And luckily, Autism Pensacola was around at that time and had a lot of resources, not as many as now, but that were able to help. And then you just research, and you really hope that the research you're getting online is good research, because as a parent, you're just bombarded with everything that you can find that says, this will help, and this will help, and this will help. And so a lot of times as a parent, you're just like, you'll do anything for your child. So I think one of the things that we really try to do is educate the community about, these are the things you can do for your child that are research-based. These are the things that actually have data to show that they're effective. This is some of the best way to spend your time and money, because that time and money is so limited and precious for families. So that's how I felt about it when I got into it. It was tough, yeah.
Well, then let me ask you, as a parent, what do you hope is available in the future that isn't available now?
I'll tell you what scares me is services for our children as they become adults, because we actually have a lot more services for them when they're children compared to what happens once they become 18 or 21, and now insurance isn't covering them, or they're back in the Medicaid system, and what do they do for an employment, and how are they going to be sustainable, and how as a community are we going to be able to support them? And I think that's an area as a whole that we really need to work on, because our kids are not 3 years old forever. They grow up and they become adults, and we need to take care of them just as much then, and make sure that they're able to take care of themselves. And that scares me as a parent. I just want the best for him.
There are, for kids with more significant needs, sometimes they are able to get into services, but usually you have to do that so many years in advance that sometimes there's a big gap there. Parents find out that they didn't apply early enough, or, you know, their children just don't qualify.
Yeah, I was going to say that I think that burnout with families and being so overwhelmed is just, it's overwhelming, and I felt that way too, and it was a relief when I actually came to a place where they were able to educate me and teach me, and I didn't feel quite so overwhelmed. But I think that's why parent training is so important, because we're only with these children as professionals for a few years at most, and the parents are with their kids for the rest of their life. That's why I went back to school and became a behavior analyst, because the day that they tell me my insurance doesn't cover, you know, ABA anymore is the day I say, well, then I know how to do it at home. And I feel like, especially since we don't know what kind of services are available for our kids as they get older.
Okay, finally, my favorite question. I love asking people this. What didn't I ask you that people should really know?
There is still a lot of that pressure, I'd say, for families to try things, like whether it's a special diet or whether it's, you know, hate to say fad, but there's a lot of things that do go through that aren't research-based. And if you get online, sometimes you feel like, I need to try those things. And that, you know, what if that would work for my child and I didn't try it? So we're getting a little bit more away from that, I think, than we did, because we're educating families and the community, and people are becoming more savvy about knowing where to look it up and what's reputable and what isn't. But applied behavior analysis, for many people, when they hear ABA, they still don't know what that is. So that's one of the reasons we do a class on just an introduction to what is ABA. How do you know a good provider? What should I be looking for? Because people they're just trying to educate themselves sometimes. So we're doing what we can to assist with that.
I think as a parent over the years, especially early on, bothered me more than it does now. When your child is upset at the store or is having a meltdown, per se. A lot of people will say, you just need to, you know, do this or that, and they'll calm down, or just get them to tell you what they want, even though my kid couldn't talk at the time. And it used to be that I would try to give these reasons why my son was behaving the way he was. Oh, he has autism. Oh, he can't say hi to you right now because he has autism. And then over time, I just didn't feel like I needed to make excuses for why my child was who he was. Any child that you come upon in the store has different things that are going on with them. You aren't going to know their whole background and history. So I don't believe any parent needs to go through their entire history of their child to a stranger about why my child is behaving the way they are, as long as that child is safe and being taken care of, I mean, as a community, that's what we should be concerned with. But it is heartbreaking as a parent to believe that other people are looking at you as if you're not a good parent. And that is not the case. Even the families who come to us for help, it is not because they are a terrible parent. It is just because they need some additional tools in their tool belt of things that they can use to help their child. And in no way does it mean that they're a poor parent or that they're not doing their job. All of our parents adore their children. They're amazing and are doing what's right for them. And I think they need some confidence, you know, that, you know what, I'm trying to do what's right for my kid. And I think we need to view them as that and not, you know, what they're not doing for their kid. Because it's hard. And it'll break your heart. Like, I cried many a night, you know, from feeling like people were, you know, judging me or my son, you know, when he was doing the best he could and I was doing the best I could. That's tough.
Debbie Kermes is a board-certified behavior analyst and the manager of the Autism Center at Sacred Heart Children's Hospital in Pensacola. Jennifer Finley is also a behavior analyst at the center and a parent of a child with autism. Next week on The Best of Our Knowledge, we will go one step further and look at what happens when a child with autism becomes an adult. One of the most important parts of the school day is recess. Who knew? Well, someone did, and that's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Recess is a favorite among elementary school students. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Dale Fink, associate professor of education at the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts, explains what happens when recess is taken away for bad behavior.
To many children, very little that happens during a school day is more important than recess. That is why, for better or for worse, teachers in many elementary classrooms put recess on the chopping block. They threaten to take it away to encourage better focus on academics and compliance with classroom rules. I have wondered how teachers think about this strategy of turning recess into a bargaining chip, what students think about it, and if anyone knows whether it is achieving its objectives. I designed a study that began with surveys of teachers in three school districts. Nearly 100% believed there were both physical and social benefits to recess. In spite of this, 95% of teachers of grades 1 through 5 did withhold students' recess. In a second phase of the study, I interviewed third and fifth graders. Most of my interviewees were understanding of their teachers' strategies. Wesley recalled, "One time I had to work on some writing and I missed the whole recess, but it was very productive." Kobe stated, "It's not a good feeling. You see the other kids are playing and you're on the wall. But it's a consequence. You have to deal with what you did." They were understanding of teachers' agendas, but they loved recess. They filled my notebooks with tales of what they liked to do at recess, mostly revolving around friendships and physical activities. Many wished there was an alternative to the denial of recess. Mitch said, "If it was up to me, I would let everybody go outside and find some other way to give consequences, but I'm not sure what that other way could be. I am still in the process of interpreting my data, but some data need very little interpretation. For instance, these words from Beatrice: teachers don't remember what it's like to be kids. They don't remember they have made the same mistakes."
That was Dale Fink of the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.